Okay, welcome back, everybody. We are now going to record episode 3 of this podcast, and this will be my first in-person as a single co-host. So I'm Daniela, and I have the honor of having Dr. Flores here today as my first guest on this podcast. So I'll pass it on to Dr. Flores to go ahead and introduce himself.
You already introduced me, so I don't have to introduce myself. No, I will. I'm just messing with you. So that's a big part of me is I like to tease students. So I might be doing a little bit of that during the podcast. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
All right. So my name is Robert Flores. I was a professor here at Cal Poly for 37 years. Prior to that, I taught high school up in Hollister, California, at San Benito High School. And I taught there for 5 years. So I have 42 years in education. I've been retired now for more than three and a half years. And I got to tell you, it's wonderful. But I got to be honest with you. I really miss teaching. So I still get asked to teach classes now and then. And in fact, I'm teaching graduate classes right now. And it's just a part-time whenever I want to. And it's a pretty neat feeling. So you want to know a little bit of background, huh?
Yes. We want to have the audience know a little bit about you and why you are an excellent guest on this podcast.
Excellent?
Yes.
Oh, you really do honor me. Okay, just to share a little bit about me. I'm originally from, I always tell people, beautiful Bakersfield.
Ooh. Okay.
So originally from Bakersfield, I come from a family of 10. I have 5 brothers, 2 sisters, and most all of them live there. I was the only one I was the first one to leave. And now one of my sisters lives up in the Sacramento area. So most of my family is still there. And in fact, one of my sons, he located there after graduation from Cal Poly. So 5 brothers, 2 sisters, Catholic family. My parents originally were from, my father's family was from Jalisco, down in Mexico. And then my mother's was from close to DF, so right there, the state of Mexico. And I never really got to meet those relatives because I only got to know one of my grandparents, my grandfather. So my parents lost their parents early on. So it was quite interesting. It's very different from what a lot of students experience today. I don't know if you still have your grandparents, but many families nowadays, because, you know, people are healthier, they live longer, medicine's improved, eating is improved, and so on. And I say that because I think that's very important, to know a lot, to know your history, to know where you come from. And if you don't have grandparents to teach you that, or grandparents to kind of share with your parents on a regular basis, who then share with you where you come from, it makes it a little difficult. So I've been able to piece together this and that regarding my family and my background. So I went to high school there. I also went to Bakersfield College for 1 year, but I had to get out. Actually, I was getting in trouble. I grew up in, a Catholic family. I went to a Catholic private school. So I went private school all the way up until 8th grade. And then when I got to high school, oh boy. Things started to change. I started to see a bigger world, see more opportunity, and more opportunity to a teenage boy could mean trouble if you're not careful. So I needed to move away, and so I chose to come to Cal Poly. So I came to Cal Poly, got a degree in animal science, and I decided I wanted to teach. And so I found a professor by the name of Joe Sable, Dr. Joe Sable. So Joe Sable became my mentor, and I told him what I wanted to do. And in fact, one time we were talking, and he goes, "So what do you want to do? Look at your future. What do you want to do?" I said, "I want your job." Just like that, I told him, "I want your job." And he looked at me, and he smiled real big, and I said, "I'm not kidding, Dr. Sable, I want your job." And guess what I got down the way? Dr. Sable's job. Dr. Sable became an associate dean, then he was an interim dean, and so on. But he's the one who actually hired me back. So the only reason I'm telling you that is because if you don't tell people what your goals are, what your dreams are, how would they know? Are they just supposed to guess? Mm-hmm. So right now, if there's a professor here, you want to take their job, you need to go tell them, I want your job someday. And then they'll watch you and they'll keep after you, especially if they're a mentor. They'll watch out for you and they'll help you along the way. Is that enough background for now?
Yes. I have met Dr. Flores when I was a first year during my Zoom years, but then I met him in person my second year when I finally got to Cal Poly's campus. Always been such a great help in the Latino community within the College of Ag. So I'm enjoying learning about you and your background. I knew about some of it, but not all of it. Like, I'm getting to know now.
Oh, there's more, and there's stuff that I won't ever share with you.
But a key takeaway that Dr. Flores is letting all of us know is to build our network. It's not what you know, it's who you know, which is a saying that is, like, key in everything, especially with the mentors, just as Dr. Flores just talked about. They'll definitely help us, not only now, but, like, as we progress through our careers. So with that, we'll go into discussing why did you get involved in agriculture? Who introduced you to agriculture?
Oh, okay. That's really good. Well, since we didn't have a complete family yet, but when we were living in Bakersfield, we were actually living in an urban area, and the place wasn't big enough for a family of 10. So my father and mother decided we need to move. So they moved to the outskirts, what then would be the outskirts now. It's not so much outskirts because everything's grown up around it, but out by the fairgrounds, the Kern County Fairgrounds. So we moved out there, and guess what? We were introduced right away, and that was when I was going into fifth grade. We were introduced to 4-H, and so 4-H is really the start. So there was a very active 4-H club in the area, and all of us that were eligible, we joined the 4-H, and since 4-H takes you at age 9, I was perfect to get started there. So we had enough property there. We had, you know, it was only about an acre, but it was all zoned for, you know, animals and whatever else you wanted to do. We weren't growing marijuana then, so. Now you want to switch the topic, right?
Of course. When you guys first got introduced to 4-H, what animals did you guys start with?
We started with, now the one thing that we could not do, we probably could do them, but we weren't interested was hogs. We did not do hogs at all.
Oh, okay.
So sheep, we started with sheep, and then we raised cattle. We raised some especially replacement heifers, dairy, what they call Springer heifers,
mm-hmm.
and dairy, Holstein cattle. And then my older brother got really wild, and he started raising chickens. And we're talking about laying hens. And he got a job at Farmer John Egg Ranch, which is a big egg ranch in that area. And so he bought a whole bunch of Leghorn chickens, and he had a whole operation going. I'm going, whoa. So it was kind of my brother. I have an older sister, too. She started in 4-H, but she stayed more along the, you know, the clothing area of 4-H. But my brother got started with the animals, and so I said, wow, he could do all of that? So he was raising all of these laying hens and selling eggs to all the neighbors, and people driving by were always stopping to get eggs. And so I said, well, chickens aren't my thing. So then that's when I went from sheep to cattle. And then from 4-H, once we got into high school, we went into FFA. So we were part of that also.
Okay. So during that time in 4-H or FFA, was there a moment that confirmed your passion for continuing agriculture, or was it more watching your brother build his business?
No, it was teachers
okay.
all the way.
Advisors.
So I had an advisor. His name was Don Schuett, Mr. Schuett. And Mr. Schuett was an older man, so he was nearing retirement. And in comes, I think it was like my third year, my junior year, in comes Bill Kelly. And so Mr. Kelly is the one who really got me going, saying, oh, you ought to be doing this, and you ought to be moving this way. And then I said, oh, really? There are jobs out there? And then he's the one who said, you'd make a great teacher. And Mr. Kelly taught at South High School in Bakersfield until Bakersfield College called on him to teach. And he probably taught 55 years. He retired only a few years back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. But he was the one who said, you ought to be a teacher. And so I said, so what do I do? And that's when I came to Cal Poly to get an animal science degree. Back then, you couldn't go straight into teaching. You had to come take another major, and then you did teaching your fifth year only. In other words, there was no agricultural science degree. You had to major in animal science or ag business or ag engineering or something else, and then go into teaching. So I was animal science and then moved into teaching. And that's where, so from Bill Kelly, I came over here, and then found Dr. Sable, and he helped me. And so agriculture, I said, yeah, this is pretty cool. I like it.
Oh, that's so cool to learn, especially me coming from the Central Valley and being familiar with, like, South High School and Bakersfield College.
I know, and South High School doesn't even have a program anymore.
Oh, wow.
Unless they restarted again. But it died after many, many years. It struggled. A lot of programs, you know, they go through this wave. They're on a high, and then they start to go down.
Yeah.
Then they get a new exciting teacher, and then they go up. And then, you know, it's just the way a lot of programs go.
Yeah. It's a part of the FFA chapter, like, organization.
It's an evolution. Across. It's a continuing evolution. Yeah.
Wow, that's so cool. I also have a similar, like, connection with also learning through my FFA advisors on learning about even ag communications being a major. Honestly, I had no idea it was something that could be offered at Cal Poly until my advisor told me about it, and he's the one who got me to apply, to come here.
Well, you know where ag communication came from was Dr. Scott Vernon actually came up with the idea. But for many years, he tried to get it as an approved major here on campus, and he was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. And then Richard Gearhart, in the department.
KBSY and news anchor.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then he wanted to get it in, and it didn't happen. It didn't work. And so I was department head on the second try, and so I stepped down as department head. I said, I don't want to be department head anymore. My focus was going to be to get the ag communication major approved. So I went and got on the curriculum committee in the college, and I started talking to people about ag communication, and In another year, we were able to get the major approved. I was so happy. I felt like I'd done something finally, you know?
Yeah.
Because ag science had been around for a long time. Ag communication had been a minor for a long time. We just could not get it through the curriculum process to get approved as a major. Because people didn't, everybody's going, so ag communication, what is that? What is that? Yet other campuses, you know, I'm talking about other universities already had it.
Mm-hmm.
But we had been doing it for years, and our students had been successful out there in jobs related to ag communications, but there was no major. They had a major in ag science with a minor in ag communication. So I would say that that's one of my legacies, and I'm pretty proud of it. But I'm always going to give Dr. Vernon and Mr. Gearhart credit for all of their work in getting that off the ground.
Oh, I didn't know that. Sorry, but thanks to all you guys, I was able to know about ag communications and complete my undergrad. And I mean, here we are, ag communications with this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
For all our audience to learn about, you know, what agriculture has to offer that they don't know about.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, it's always a process. You want to introduce something, and then there's always going to be people out there that don't understand it, don't think it's the right way to go, don't see a future in it, or whatever it might be. And sometimes it just takes, you know, persistence.
Yes.
And so that would be something else I would promote, the idea of persistence. If it's something you believe in, don't let the door shut on you. You keep your foot stuck in there, and you figure out ways. You got to come up with strategies.
Yes.
And here, working at a university, there's a lot of times you have to come up with strategies to make things really work. And you can't do it alone.
Oh, yeah.
You may think you want to do stuff alone. That, you know, you come into the university, oh, I'm this, I'm that, whatever. Uh-uh. You ain't nothing without other people on your side. You're only one person. You need others to understand what it is you're about and what it is you're trying to do.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, like the saying goes, it takes a village to, you know, complete anything or accomplish a goal. Mm-hmm. Here we are with our village here, Sophia, my other co-host, Dr. Flores, a prominent professor from the department, and I mean the department itself helping us do this podcast with the equipment, you know?
I think it's great.
It's even a whole village to help us put this podcast on, which honestly, I can't do this all by myself. I obviously need the help of others to complete this project. But going back to you saying you need a team whenever you're working with the university, how was your preparation and experience working here at Cal Poly as a professor and as a department chair?
Okay, so that is interesting in itself because we do not hire people this way anymore. So when I was teaching in high school at San Benito High School, I got a call from Dr. Sable, and he said, we've got a position. And he goes, would you be interested? Well, back then, they could hire you without the terminal, what they call the terminal degree. And the terminal degree in agricultural education is a PhD or an EdD. Either way, it's a doctorate. You have to have a doctorate. And so I said, so how's this going to work? And he said, well, you would come here, you would establish yourself, and then you have to run off and get your PhD. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. And, of course, I was married at the time. I didn't even talk about marriage along the way. Ay, ay, ay.
You didn't even talk that's about what I get. Your wife.
Well, I didn't talk about all my kids either. But there's only three of all of them. There's only three.
I mean, we can take a pause. We'll talk about them now.
Okay, we'll take a pause. We'll talk about them now. So here I am at Cal Poly, and I'm ready to graduate. And I was downtown. I won't tell you where I was downtown, but I was downtown. And there was a student. There was a female sitting, you know, with some friends. And I knew she was in my Ag Business 301 class, which is the Ag Marketing class. I think it's still the same right now, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Some things don't change, huh?
Oh, no. Never change.
So she was in the class, and so I just walked over and said, hey, how you doing? And, of course, I had a beer in my hand, and you know, he gave me the courage to go up. And so we just got to talking. And then, you know, then I just remember she had been in my class. And so, yeah, met my wife at Cal Poly, too, in an Ag Business 301 class. I always joke with people and said she was cheating off me all the time. But it was probably the other way around.
Maybe. Perhaps.
No, we weren't cheating. We would never do that. But it was, Came to Cal Poly and found my wife. So, yeah, we've been married. This is our 45th year of marriage.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, we're getting old.
A big accomplishment.
Okay. And then we had, so the reason I brought up my wife is because when I was teaching in Hollister, that's when we got married, and we had a son, our oldest son. He lives in Montana. He's 40-ish now. And so it wasn't a matter of just coming to Cal Poly. So when Dr. Sable called me, you can't just pick up and say, okay, family, we're leaving. Because my wife was working. She's a banker. She worked for Farm Credit System. So she was the Gilroy assistant manager, whatever they called him. But it turns out sometimes things, you know, they just work out. So here in San Luis Obispo, they had an opening at the office, and they wanted to hire a manager for the office. They hired her. And the office used to be right there on Santa Rosa Street, right across from the veterinary hospital. They used to have a branch right there. Way back when. Now they moved it all to Arroyo Grande. But she worked in that office, and then she went down to Arroyo Grande to open up that office. And then I was here at Cal Poly. Dr. Sable said, you got to go off and get your terminal degree. So eventually, I think this was 1986, I decided to go to Texas A&M. I had toured some of the other institutions, and Texas A&M was the one I wanted to go to. Because they said, you can work as fast as you want. But they said, normally it takes 3 years to get your doctorate. They said, we won't hold you back. You can work as fast as you want. And the thing is, the state director of ag education at the time, he had a project he wanted me to do. So I already had my doctorate project all thought up, my dissertation. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'll fund it if they'll let you do it.
Oh, wow.
So, but I had no idea how to do it. I just knew that he wanted this information. So it was a study of Latino participation in the South Coast region of FFA. And he said, if you do this study, then we'll consider doing it for all of the other regions. And because I was in the South Coast region as a teacher, I knew all the teachers. It was like, whoa, this is pretty cool, because all of these teachers are going to help me because they're going to distribute all the materials to their students and encouraging them to fill them out. It worked out wonderfully. So I went to Texas. My wife stayed here with our oldest son, who was a young baby at the time. And she would come visit, and then I'd come visit too. But I was in Texas A&M, and I was focused on getting my doctorate done. I finished all my classes in 1 year. I was taking...
Oh, my God.
They said they would not hold me back. I took as many units as I could. So it was 100% devoted to getting it done. And then I stayed another half year to finish all the writing. My dissertation ended up being over 300 pages. They told me that if I went any more, they said, you need to stop. That's what my advisor told me. He goes, you need to stop, because if you go any more, then we have to go to 2 volumes. And they didn't want to read 2 volumes. Honestly, they didn't want to read 2 volumes. So I had all this information, because I got 90, it was over 90% participation on my survey. They said nobody ever gets that high. And it was thousands of students. We're talking thousands of surveys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took all of this data, fed it into a computer, a machine, manipulated all of it to get the answers I wanted, doing all kinds of statistical procedures. I had really good professors there that helped me. And I was in their offices all the time. So, again, I picked Texas A&M because I knew these two professors would give me the time of day. And they co-advised me. They became co-advisors. Usually you only have one main advisor. Mm-hmm. And they said they would co-advise me. So I'd come in, slap papers in front of them, tell them I'll be back tomorrow or the next day, and then come in and ask them. And if they didn't have it, I would keep bugging them to get my papers from them. And that's the way you got things done. Yeah. That's the way you should get things done. So they saw me pretty regularly. I think they were tired of me. That's why they actually graduated me. I think they wanted me out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, you're being very persistent with with everything you do. I mean, is the way you're going to accomplish. And I mean, they said it was a 3-year program and you got it done in 1 year.
Well, one and a half.
Oh, yeah.
One and a half. And then when I came here, get back to Cal Poly, started working in January. Because I'd been gone, so I came back to the quarter system in January of the second year. And then I could communicate with them, because once you give them the package, then it has to go to somebody. They edit it. They redline all kinds of stuff. You got to make all the corrections. So it was back and forth for another 2 months.
Oh, okay.
And so my actual graduation is in May from Texas A&M, because I got the approvals and everything was complete. So it was a two-year program, but I was only gone a year and a half.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
But I was so fortunate that they said they would let me do it in the amount of time I wanted to do it. Because I said 3 years. I never told them. I said, I'm not staying here 3 years. I never told them that. But I had no intention of being there 3 years. I mean, my wife and son were here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So...
It's so good that they give you that kind of project that you were so interested in doing, and then the support you received as well.
Would you like to read my dissertation?
I would. Mia Sofia said in the opening episode, we hope to someday apply to PhD programs.
I'll bring it in, and you can read it. I think I even printed it in small books. I know I printed it in small books. I'd have to find them.
If we can get our hands on them before, summer when we're gone, I will still read it.
Okay, I don't know if you want
just
to read the whole thing.
An idea of what
it takes
to do
what
for
it takes.
A PhD.
Yeah, absolutely. Be happy to help.
Awesome. So that was your preparation to become a professor at Cal Poly, or to become a department chair?
To become, okay, so When I came to Cal Poly, I came in a tenure track position, meaning I was a professor. But there was no way they would tenure me nor allow me to advance without the doctorate.
Okay.
That was part of the agreement, so I had to do all of that. So that's why I went and got the doctorate. And then the minute I came back, then I got tenured right away, and then I got moved to associate professor. You start off as assistant professor, then you move to associate professor, then you move to full professor. And each one of those takes several years, and you've got to go through review committees. It's not like it just happens.
Mm-hmm.
You have to publish. You know, you have to do a lot of publishing. Back then, we could do a lot of service, and that service would count. So I was, you know, I was so involved in CATA when I started as a teacher. I was CATA president while I was here at Cal Poly.
For those of you who do not know what CATA, what is that, Dr. Flores? Because our audience is very broad. It's available to everybody. So we're here teaching our audience at the same time.
Oh, so I better not tell any lies, huh? You got people listening? They'll say, oh, man, this guy's lying. No. California Agricultural Teachers Association, and it's the professional organization for anybody who is teaching agriculture. And it's primarily for those that are teaching K through 14, although it also includes university teacher educators in agriculture. So all of them are part of this professional organization.
So for those of you who may not know what the CATA is, it's also like a conference that ag teachers who are FFA advisors, they come to this every summer here at San Luis Obispo.
We host a summer conference, and we have every year that it's had a summer conference except for one. Every year held here except for one.
Was that COVID year?
They actually held... You know what? That's a good point, because during COVID, I think they had to do it remotely.
Oh, okay.
So maybe that's 2 years. But that's right. So Cal Poly still arranged for a lot of it, but it was remote during COVID. So it's 2 years it was not held here on campus. The 1 year was during World War II. And the reason? Because the coastal community, we were threatened with ships off the shore. And they were afraid that this was actually a zone you could not host any large gatherings, because they were afraid that the Japanese would attack the California coast. So it wasn't held here at Cal Poly. But other than that, it's always held here. And then, of course, you know, there's sectional meetings, there's regional meetings, and then there's only one state conference, and the state conference is held here.
So, yeah, that's a little bit about what, like, CATA is and how Dr. Flores was involved with that organization during his time as an advisor.
Yeah, I think it was 1986 I was president of CATA.
Wow.
And then that's when that's the same year. So no sooner did I participate in conference than I packed my bags and I was off to Texas A&M.
Okay, so during your time in your career, so throughout your career, did you ever face any challenges or situations, and how did you overcome it?
Oh,
it could be like
tons of them, all the time. It was all the time.
What is one you want to share with everybody?
Well, I remember when I came to Cal Poly, there was a guy in the Student Academic Services, Everardo Martinez, and we became friends. It was Ev and then Armando Peso Silva were the two that were here. And they came up to me one time. In fact, Everardo graduated in ornamental horticulture. They had an ornamental horticulture degree at the time. And he was here as a student when I was. Then he just stayed and kept working with the Student Academic Services. And he came up to me and he goes, "Hey, Flores, if you ever leave Cal Poly, then we're going to have lost 25% of our Latino faculty." He's the one who told me that. I'm going, So who are the other ones? Because I haven't met them yet. And it turns out there was one in education. His name was David Sanchez. And David Sanchez had been here for quite some time. So Dr. Sanchez. And then he left. I mean, he was in his final years as a professor, and he retired. Oh, probably somewhere in the, maybe in the 90s, maybe in the early 90s. But he was very popular. He was here. And honestly, I can't tell you who the other two were. But we were few and far between. So it was very different back then to find, you know, Latino faces involved in higher education, especially in agriculture. Think about it.
Yeah.
In agriculture. The only Latino faces you saw in agriculture, they were out harvesting harvesting the crops, processing the crops, driving the tractors, and doing all of that. And if they had children going to college, they weren't majoring in agriculture. Mm-hmm. You know, so
the Latino community, you're going to be a licenciada or you're going to be a doctor.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and that would be the same, I think, for even the Anglo community. You know, everybody wants their child to become the best they could be. You want to be a doctor or, an astronaut or whatever. But it was never. How about agriculture? No way. Why would you ever want to do that? Where's that going to take you? All of those attitudes have changed. You know, if I go back to high school, when I went to San Benito High School to teach, there was one other person that I worked with. A guy by the name of Dave Wemp. And Dave had been there for 5 or 6 years. He taught me a lot, but the one thing I knew about it is San Benito County has a high Latino population. Yet in the ag program, there were hardly a Latino student to be found. And I thought, how sad. But, you know, if you don't see a role model, if you don't see anyone that looks like you or comes from the same background, you kind of think, well, that must not be for me. So I stayed at Hollister 5 years. And honestly, if Dr. Sable had not called me, I'd still be there today because I loved it. I loved teaching high school there. It was great. But by the time I left, we had the whole school was like 1,200 students. We, rather than having 100 students in ag, because that's about all there were, or 100 in ag, we had over 400, and most of them were Latino. They started to realize, hey, there's something else we could do, you know? And so I was pretty proud of that, the fact that when I left there, there was a lot bigger Latino population. So all of this kind of works all the way into my dissertation and everything along the way. And the state supervisor saying, this is what I want you to do and whatever. It all worked out. And again, it's your contacts. So if you're going to burn bridges along the way, I don't think people are going to run to help you. And then you also have to be vulnerable. That's a key. You have to tell people, hey, I don't know exactly what I'm doing, but this is what I'm interested in doing. How do I do that? Because if you don't ask, how do you find out?
Yeah.
You got to ask. And so... And, you know, I'm a strong introvert. You may not believe that, but I am a strong introvert. So I had a hard time asking. And it had to be one-on-one with people. I couldn't ask in a big setting. I could never do that. But I will say the only reason I speak up is because I was in 4-H and FFA. FFA more so. If it wasn't for FFA and the leadership part of the program, because I was doing Parley Pro, I was doing all that stuff. If I wasn't doing that, I probably wouldn't have had the skill set or the confidence to ask the questions that needed to be asked. I think that's what ag programs do. A lot of people say, why do we have FFA in agriculture at the high school level? Well, the reason you have it is because it develops self-confidence in individuals. They learn to speak up, even if they never continue with a career in ag. I think it's the program that brings the self-confidence out of them, self-esteem, responsibility, all of those things. That's what the program builds in people. It did it for me.
I mean, I 100% believe it. I'm also an introvert, and if you know me, I'm like very shy. Mm-hmm. I won't talk to people, but thanks to FFA and even just the speaking competitions, judging competitions,
yep.
showing animals. I mean, I got to learn how to ask. It's also very hard for me now even to ask, but I feel like over the years and now being like a current master's student, I've had more confidence in asking for help because there should be no shame. I mean, in asking, you're honestly being the bravest one and wanting to complete the steps correctly by asking those questions, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, that's why I was telling you about my grandparents. I didn't have my grandparents to teach me certain things along the way. And then my parents, with eight of us, eight children. So which one are you going to work with today? I got to work with all of them, you know? So my poor parents, I always think, eight kids. So, and my parents did not go to college. My mom started taking classes in college while I was in high school. She started taking classes. And you know the only reason she started doing that? Is because my youngest brother, the eighth child, was now in school. So now she could pursue something she had never achieved, getting a college degree. And my dad had taken classes. He had his AA, but that was it. And so we had nobody to teach us about college.
Yeah.
I was the first one and ran off. So I think that's a critical piece too. You know, you don't know what it takes to do this or to get that. I remember moving to Cal Poly. I just loaded up my truck with whatever I thought I needed. I didn't even know where I was going. And I ended up at Standard Glen. It used to, I don't know what it's called now, but it's right there at the corner of Foothill and Highway 1 and Santa Rosa. It's that housing that's got the big parking lot back there. I don't even know what it's called now. But that's where I ended up. And it's only because I saw a brochure and I said, I need a house. I'll pay whatever. And I ended up there. So I came. I mean, it was scary.
Oh, yeah. It's a first generation story.
I didn't know anybody here. Like I said, I did this on my own. So it was pretty scary. And for an introvert to do all that on his own, yeah. I was always looking over my back, you know, going, am I in the right place? Am I supposed to be here? You know, all of that. And even then, Cal Poly was very low Latino population coming to college here. Very, very low. We were probably like 3 or 4%. That's not much.
Wow. So during your time, you know, navigating being a first generation college student, did you ever find like your support system here on campus? Or how long did it take to find that support system and like your peers?
Well, I went to classes. I did well in classes. I enjoyed college. I did fairly well. I don't even remember what my GPA was, but I was Dean's List pretty regularly. It was kind of something I needed to do. And there were some tough classes. I remember I took 4 chemistry classes. I had to take 2 inorganics, an organic, a biochem. And then when I got into animal science, I had to take more. That was the applied chemistry in animal science back then. So it was pretty intense. We had to take 2 zoology classes, all kinds of, I mean, I'm kind of going, it was really science-based.
Yeah.
But I the one thing I could tell you that I don't think my whole time at college I ever missed a class. I do not think I ever missed a class. I did not study in groups. So no support there. I had to do it on my own. I took my own notes. That's why I had to be in class every day. So even if I was feeling like, maybe I don't need to be there today, I was there because I was taking notes, you know? And then I even got a job taking notes for a student in the disabled services.
Oh, yes.
I got hired on to be a note taker for a student. And so that helped because I got some money for doing that. But I'm just telling you, it was coming to college. It was a scary thing, but then I made friends. And once you start making friends, then all of the friends, we eventually, my second year here, we found a house over on Church Street, and a whole bunch of us moved into the house. And this is what's really funny. This house only has 2 bedrooms. We ended up in 1 bathroom. We ended up with 6 of us in the house, and we got along great. We put one guy out in the garage. One guy was in the washroom, and then two people in each of the rooms. And so there's six guys. So we got our rent down. Believe it or not, our rent was like $43 a month.
Oh, my God.
Well, you got to remember, 43 was worth a lot more money back then.
Yeah.
But still, it was, nobody could believe it. They go, you guys pay what? And so, and we got along so well. That was the key, finding people you could get along with. We came up with schedules for who would wash the dishes, who would sweep, who had responsibilities with this. It worked out great. And, you know, there was one guy that was the slob. He's the one that had to go out to the garage to sleep. Because he was a total slob. I remember one time I had to go to the laundromat. This is a funny story. I had to go to the laundromat, and I was out of clothes. And I said, hey, Jim, do you have any T-shirts? I said, all my stuff's kind of dirty. He says, sure, I just did a load. I go in my room and get it. So I go in his room, and I open the drawers. He had a chest of drawers there. I open them up. Every one of them is empty. And I said, where are your clothes? Oh, I just threw them on the floor when I came back home. So he wanted me to go through his clothes that were on the floor and find something to wear. That's the kind of guy. I couldn't tell what was clean and what wasn't. So I never asked Jim for clothes anymore.
Valid, very valid. But oh my God, that's just crazy. I mean, nowadays it's impossible to find, I mean, six people in a two-bedroom.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, you want to hear more. So we were in that house together for, I was there for 2 years with them, because then I went off to student teach in Hanford.
Oh, okay.
But on the second year, I was the one in charge, by the way. I was in charge. The house was rented to me. And the only reason I got the house was because a husband-wife team, they needed someone to take over the rent right away because they were leaving town. They found a job somewhere and they were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came over to see them. Back then, there was no internet. There was none of this. You had to find out by the newspaper. Or somebody printed something and put it up on a bulletin board. So I read the newspaper. I read the newspaper, and there was house. And everybody else already had their house. Everybody was set. Here I am. Nothing. And so I went to them, and I said, really? $250 for this place? And they go, yeah, but we got to get out of the lease. Will you take it over? So there in the spot, I said yes, and I had no one else to live with me. And $250 back then would be like me having to pay more than 10 times that. I mean, you think about what a dollar was worth back then. It was more than 10 times that. That was on me. So I went to all of these guys that I knew from Stener Glen and said, hey, you guys up for this? And all of them jumped in. And then we ended up with a couple more. So, I don't know. Something was on my side. It all worked out.
Yeah.
It all worked out. So that was just funny stories from there. I could tell you more stories, but some of them would not be appropriate for this podcast.
I mean, just being in college and navigating, like, housing and where to live. I remember being in that same spot my second year and, like, freaking out because we didn't know where to go. I mean, that was, a few years ago where we did have access to the internet and to Facebook Market, like, rooms being posted. And I remember just being like, oh, my God, am I going to live in the street?
It's stressful.
Yes.
Because if I hadn't found that house, I would have been living in my truck.
Mm-hmm.
My truck had a camper shell, so I figured, you know, find a place to park. I had slept in it before, so it wasn't like it was something new to me. But,
Especially navigating that part of life, being a first-generation college student. When I couldn't call my parents to ask them, how do I fill out this lease application? It was all, like you said,
It was all word of mouth.
On yourself, yep. Yeah.
And so I had to pay. So by the time I left, all the other people were staying. They still had another year of study when I left to go to student teach. And I went to the lady, and the lady, I would deliver the check to her because everybody would pay me. I was in charge. So I went to see the lady, the landlady. She lived out there off of Hygera, and I would always drop off a check to her or pay her cash. And I told her I was leaving town and that so-and-so was going to stay, and he would now be in charge of the house. if that was okay. And she goes, you guys have been the best tenants ever. You have always paid me on time, and you've never had a problem. She had to replace the water heater one time, but that wasn't on us. The water heater gave out.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, you guys are the best. And I'm kind of going, never heard that from anyone before. So it was a pretty good deal. Yeah. And so they stayed there, and I don't even know where all of them ever ended up. I know some of them. I see them every now and then, but most of the roommates, they kind of disappeared. In fact, one's a fire chief down in the Fillmore area. Another one lives in Canada. He's the one that I keep in touch with. I go see him up in British Columbia. And then one taught at Coast Union High School. He was the cross-country coach. He just recently retired. So, you know, but all the rest, I don't know where they are.
Now that you mentioned that you left the place.
By the way, are we even answering the questions you wanted to ask?
Because yeah.
I have this tendency to go all over the place. Because when you ask me stuff, it triggers this. You know, most times at my age, most of my memory's in the cloud. And so I have to, like, wait. And it's a bad connection. So it takes a while for it to come down. But you're triggering all kinds of stuff, memories.
I hope it's a good thing.
It is.
But now that you said in your previous response that you left that, you know, apartment to go student teach in Hanford, how was that experience being a student teacher?
I didn't even know where Hanford was. Here I was with Dr. Sable,
uh-huh,
and the whole staff that were here. I remember all of them. I knew all of them, okay? And I remember going up to Dr. Sable and saying, so when do we find out where we're going to student teach? And back then, you don't have a say on where you're going. They didn't care if you knew anybody or anything else. You were just going to go wherever they told you. And there were approved programs you could use, and that's it. You couldn't negotiate. It was tough. And back then, when you went to student teach, it wasn't about mentoring you. It was about washing out the weak ones. That was the mentality back then. You come and teach, and we'll see if you're worthy of teaching. And so I remember I was told, I'm going to Hanford. And I went to Dr. Sable. So this was, you know, you go to your mentor and you ask. I said, where is Hanford? Because back then, no internet, no nothing. I had to go get a map. And he pulled out, you know, one of the, you know, the California maps. You probably don't even know what that looks like. He pulled out a California map on paper. And he showed me where it was. And back then, it showed little segments and told me how many miles it was and how to get there. I had never, ever been to that part of the valley before. Never. I was from Bakersfield, but we never went anywhere. You know, I grew up with a family of 10. We were a family of 10. We stayed there. Mm-hmm. Heck, my parents couldn't take us anywhere. You know, you have to take a family of 10. You couldn't even load them up, you know. So I didn't know where Hanford was. I went there and had the best experience. There were 7 ag teachers there at the time when I went there. So I was number 8. But again, and I think this is probably the thing that helped me. I was an introvert, so I was quiet. I would ask questions when I needed help. They liked that. They didn't want somebody coming in and telling them everything they knew. I wasn't an extrovert. I wasn't going to be telling them all this. I just asked, what do I need to do? I befriended every one of them. They all became my friends. Every one of them, even the department head there. So it was a really, really good experience. But I didn't know where Hanford was, and I remembered coming to Cal Poly. I didn't know anybody at Cal Poly. I didn't know anybody at Hanford. Same thing again. And then when I went to San Benito High School and got hired, didn't know where that was. I had to borrow a car from one of my roommates because I said, oh, man, I don't know. My truck, I haven't worked on it. I had an old 65 GMC truck. That was my transportation. So I asked if I could borrow it to get up to Hollister for my interview. Mm-hmm. Drove up to Hollister, and there again, new place, great place, and enjoyed the 5 years teaching there. So a lot of great experiences. But I'm thinking that if you go there with the wrong attitude, wherever you go, if it's not the right fit, you need to leave. Everything just seemed to work out.
All right, now we heard, like, a lot about Dr. Flores, his experiences he had, you know, as a child, and his upbringings up into his professional career. We're kind of nearing the end, so one of the last questions, I know he answered it in the beginning, he's currently retired and working time to time as a graduate professor. What are you currently doing besides that, or just as a retiree?
Whatever I want. You know, the neat part about retirement, I think when I retired, I became busier than I was as a professor here. So I was a professor and department head. I was department head twice. Remember I told you I was department head, and I said, I need time off to work on the communication package. And then when Dr. Kellogg retired, then the dean asked me if I would be department head again. And he was a new dean. This was a different dean. And so, it was Dr. Thulin. Let's see, was it Dr.? Dr. Thulin's the one who asked me the second time. And I said, yeah, I can do it. And so then I became department head again. So I think I was department head for 11 years. I think 7 years the first time and then 4 years. And then I finished off those 4 years with Dr. Thulin as the dean. So, it's interesting. It's being a department head, I learned a lot. And so when I retired during COVID. October 2020 was my official retirement day, but I had really retired in July. I had so much vacation time. Again, I'm the type of guy, I go to work every day.
Yeah.
I think I had one sick day in 37 years. One day that I actually took off as sick. So I had all of this vacation time. So even when I retired on October 1st, 2020, I had vacation time. So I really didn't retire until December or something. I take that back. They had to pay me the excess. And so October 1st, I think, 2020 was my official retirement day. So I retired, and I said, what am I going to do? Well, COVID was here. I didn't want to. I was no good teaching, you know, on Zoom.
Yeah.
You know, remotely. Not so much fun. So by the way, when you retire, you have to take off 6 months. You can't be asked to even teach or do anything for Cal Poly for 6 months. That's part of the agreement. So it wasn't until spring that I came back to teach again, and that's only because they asked me. I didn't do what they call the faculty early retirement program. That's what Dr. Vernon's been doing the last 4 years.
Oh, okay.
They promise you up to half time. I said, nope, I don't want any of that. I don't want any promises. I don't want to have to do that because it also holds a position. They wouldn't have been able to fill my spot. So I made a deal with the dean. I said, if I retire and I don't FERP, that's what faculty early retirement program, they call it FERP. It sounds like you have indigestion or something, but it's not really. But so I said, I don't want to do the FERP thing. And I said, will you hire somebody? And so they did. They hired an ag communication professor the minute I left, which was pretty cool. I got a call in March from the California Agricultural Leadership Foundation. They said, would you come work with us for half time? And I said, why? And they said, well, we need you. And they said, would you be the co-director of education? So Dr. Peggy Perry from Cal Poly Pomona, a friend of mine who I've known for years, she said yes. And I said, I'll say yes if she says yes. She said, she'll say yes if I say yes. So two of us said yes. I don't know who decided first. She did. She decided first. And so I became a half-time co-director of education. I did that for 3 years? 2 years? Two and a half years. So I just finished that job when they hired the new director of education who's there. I did that. And then I taught some graduate classes. I even taught some undergraduate classes, the leadership classes. By the way, the leadership minor, I'm the one who got that through. That was one of my babies. I said, we need to have a leadership minor. Nobody else. We had tried it before. It had been shot down multiple times. And I said, okay, we're going to get this through. I made friends on the curriculum committee. So I could talk to these people and I could tell them what our students need, where our students are going. I could explain what this is all about. and they would listen. We were not in that, you know, elitist competitive mode. We were friends talking. Mm-hmm. So I dotted all the I's, crossed all the T's like you're supposed to, turned in proposals, complete proposals, and they even helped me. And I remember Dr. Mary Pedersen, she became the provost here at Cal Poly when she was the associate dean in our college. I went to her and to another, Dr. Louise Berner. I went to those two and I said, can you help me out? This is what we want to do. And they helped me out. And so with their help and everybody working in the background, we got the Ag Leadership minor through too. So I was teaching undergraduate classes in Ag Leadership. I know it still hasn't taken off to the extent that it should, but someday it probably will. And I know more and more students are taking a look at it as a possible add-on to their undergraduate degree. So I was teaching those courses, doing that. Something else I started doing, in fact, if you look at this arm right here, it looks like I've been doing drugs because there's a prominent mark in one of my veins. I go every 2 weeks and give platelets.
Oh, okay.
So I donate. You can do platelets regularly because you don't lose very many red blood cells when you do platelets. So you can do that up to 24 times a year. So guess where I'm sitting? Quite a bit, because it takes more than 2 hours to do platelets. So
wow.
I told him that I'm going to go get a tattoo and it's going to be an arrow, you know, a point to where to stick the needle. I could show you. But you know how, have you ever given blood?
Yes.
So you know, you have to show your sleeves because they got to make sure you're not a drug user. You knew that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I mean, why are we going to take drugs from somebody that's all drugged out to begin? I mean, take blood from somebody who's all drugged out to begin with. So I always go short sleeves and whatever, and they say, which arm? And I said, you guess. They always know where to go because it's just like, I think I will get a tattoo, put a little arrow right there, or put a target, you know, so they know where to go every time. So I do that. That takes time.
Mm-hmm.
I started doing some gardening. I've been doing some traveling. I've been busy.
Very busy.
And now I'm one of the bereavement coordinators for Old Mission Church. By the way, you probably know I ring the bells once every week.
Yes,
so I ring the mission bells every week. Not every day of every week, just one day of the week. And so I also do, I'm a Eucharistic minister and a captain in the Eucharistic ministry. And now I'm doing, if you know what bereavement coordinator means, to help plan funerals for families. So.
Oh, okay.
I'm no good at it. I always get out the tissue boxes and they go, oh, well, thank you. I said, no, that's not for you. That's for me. We laugh about it, but, you know, you go and there's some people and you kind of go, oh, man. I mean, it makes me cry just talking about it because, you know, it's a really, it's supposed to be a joyful occasion, but it's sad at that moment, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't think I could do that, and people are convincing me that I can, and I'm kind of going, I'm still not bought into this. So there's three of us doing it, and I told them I'm their assistant because I don't want to take over because I'm kind of going, I can't do this whole thing by myself, you know.
Yes.
Then we need two boxes of tissue.
I would be in the same position as well. So I think it's probably the introvert.
Yeah.
Introvert.
And then I hang out with some guys like the Zahns brothers. Dr. Mark Zahns used to teach in ag engineering, he retired. His brother used to teach horticulture. He retired. So we go have coffee every now and then. We go see Dr. Sable. Dr. Sable's now, he's suffering from dementia, so he's now in a care facility. We go see him, you know. So I keep busy, you know. We keep in touch.
Yeah. I mean, and also helping out tremendously with the 26 hours conference.
That was always fun. But you know what? Honestly, I try to step back from that. And the reason I try to step back is because we did it one way back then. And we pretty much had a way to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And students are running the show. I never got in the way of them, but they would always ask me, how do we do this? And I'd tell them how we do this. When you leave, you always need to feel like you've prepared everybody to the extent that you can step away and let them come in with all the innovations. Don't hang on and don't overstay. That's my advice. You don't overstay your welcome. because when you overstay your welcome, then you get upset because people are changing things. And people are supposed to change things.
Yeah, that's how we all grow.
Times change too.
Yes.
You know, so when you do 26 hours now, there's a whole bunch of things you're doing differently. I needed to step back so that you guys had the room to do whatever you needed to do to keep it going and to keep it current.
Yeah.
You know, and to keep up with the times. So all of that's important to me. Very important. So you may say, how come you're not as involved as you were? Hey, it's not my show anymore. It belongs to other people. Let them do it their way. So yeah. I step back.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and close up.
I'm not done.
One last question. We're not completely over.
You guys think you're done with me, and I got all kinds of other stories I want to tell you. Okay, I'll let you finish. It's your show.
This is why everyone loves Dr. Flores the minute you meet him. I can guarantee that. But before we officially close this podcast up or this episode, our last question is, where would you like to see ag in the future?
Oh, ag in the future. You know, ag is changing by leaps and bounds on a daily basis. And, you know, it's really technology that's changing everything. Technology along with policies, regulations, all of that is changing agriculture. So, you know, the one thing I do know, ag's going to be around forever because ag feeds a nation, a hungry nation, and it feeds other nations too. We've done really good with everything we've done in agriculture, especially in California where we have, you know, the most in terms of variety.
Over 400 commodities in this state.
Yeah, this is, I mean, people can't believe that we can have all of that in this state. It's not only a big state, but it's also full of microclimates. And it's all those microclimates that allow us to grow just about everything. And so agriculture has to continue to innovate. So we need bright minds. We need a lot of youth who are studying right now, preparing for their next step in their academic career. We need them to take a look at agriculture as an opportunity because ag's going to need their mind to help to continue with those innovations, whether it be with new crops. But, I mean, think about water. Water's a big issue. Land is a big issue. Everything's moving, or it's been moving for years, towards more organics, or at least more sustainable. And, in fact, the word they want to use, they don't even want to use the word sustainable anymore. They want to use the word...
regenerative?
Regenerative is the big word. It's kind of the... You know, I remember I said sustainable to a guy that's been into organics for a long time. And he goes, oh, no, we don't use that anymore. We're regenerative. Okay, you're regenerative, whatever. But, you know, it's all of that, that we have to change. We have to meet the consumer. So ag needs to change to meet the consumer demands. But with less water, less land, we got to be more efficient. And then labor's always an issue. And we need people that can operate the machinery. And so there's a lot of opportunities. I think, you know, when you say, oh, well, then that's going to eliminate all the Latinos in the, you know, give me a break. They're the ones who are going to develop the new technologies. They're the ones that are going to develop the new varieties. They're the ones that are going to... Yeah.
We have a growing STEM industry with, I mean, the Latino community, so...
Absolutely. So it's going to take everybody. And by the way, we have more Latino producers than we ever have. Small farmers, smaller acreage, but intense agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then we have some that are moving up, getting big, and, you know, consolidating the industry and whatever. So ag's changing too. And then, you know, we've got ag management companies that are coming in and buying up. You know, they're taking all of the capital, lumping it together, and buying farmland. And, you know, you say, oh, that's bad for the family farmer. Well, in some ways it might be, but in most ways it keeps the land in farming. But somebody still has to run that operation. So we need talent. So where's ag heading? I'm not exactly sure, but I know that it's requiring a more educated workforce. Yeah.
Of course. So awesome. With that, everyone, I just want to give a big thank you again to Dr. Flores for accepting the invitation to be on our podcast.
When can I come back and tell you all my other stories?
In season two. Okay. As we said in season one, we hope this... No, we don't hope. We know this podcast is not going to go anywhere. It's going to stay here at Cal Poly or travel with Sophia and I. But... yeah, maybe he'll come back in season two, but we greatly appreciate all the effort you have put into not only Cal Poly, but also the agricultural industry, and me and Sophia as students as well, learning from you since, I mean, honestly, the minute I met you over Zoom at a Latinos in Ag meeting, I knew you'd be a prominent advisor in my academic career.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you. Awesome. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to this episode 3.